Blog Talk Radio.
Listeners, and thanks for joining me on this Saturday, June 7th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Yesterday marked the 70th anniversary of the Allied landing at Normandy beaches, the invasion of German-occupied Europe by American and United Kingdom combined forces. Since there's no controversy about the accepted history of World War II in the mainstream, the only news was about the current war in Ukraine and whether various globalist leaders will speak to one another or not when they gather, when they gathered yesterday to mark this anniversary. So 21 foreign leaders attended the commemorations, including Britain's Queen Elizabeth and Prime Minister David Cameron, Canada's Stephen Harper, as well as Germany's Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin of Russia. Now, the Ukraine's new president, Poroshenko, Peter Poroshenko, and Russia's Putin actually met, shook hands, and talked together, monitored by Merkel. So that was the big question of the day, and also whether Obama and Putin would speak, and they did. So everybody was, but not very warmly. I saw some pictures of Poroshenko and Putin looked just normal and relaxed, and Poroshenko looked a little tense, a little angry a lot of the time. But Obama gave a speech that was full of purple prose, as someone put it, of which this is an example. The United States of America is and will remain the greatest force for freedom the world has ever known as a result of its great activities and the war that it entered in 1941, of course. Since the United States is entirely run by Jews, one wonders how that can be. It can be the greatest force for freedom the world has ever known. But also, the D-Day landing didn't include the Soviet Union. And so Putin doesn't think much about D-Day or of it. In his speech, put things a little differently. He said the outcome of all of World War II was determined in the brutal battles of Moscow and Stalingrad, Kursk and Dnieper. Get it? Boy, that's quite a, he says all the outcome of all of World War II is rather a put down of the what the Western Allies did and their invasion of Europe. Of course, if it wasn't for them fighting on the Eastern Battlefront, they would have been able to deal with any invasion into Europe. But there you go. I'm not going to get into that question today, but I do want to take a look at how and why D-Day was successful, as it was, since Hitler and the Wehrmacht knew that it was in preparation. How did they prepare for it? So first, I'm going to give you a little bit of information, and I'd like to say that I think I have quite a bit here, although I don't have to say it all, but I never can quite tell how long it will take, and I do want to invite callers, if anybody would like to call in and make a comment or say something about what I'm saying here today. And the number is 323-642-1206. But I would suggest, just like I used to do at the White Network, that you don't call until the second hour, not because it would create any problems, but just so that I can get enough of my material in here before that. Although I seldom have a phone call, so I'm not expecting an avalanche of that, but I'm just letting you know, because this is a topic that a lot of people are interested in and probably have quite a bit of opinion on. So I'm going to start out by saying that the new Army Group B was formed in northern Italy under Field Marshal Erwin Rommel in 1943 to defend against a possible Allied attack there. The Army Group B was subsequently moved to northern France to defend against the D-Day landings. And on 14th of July, 1943, 11 months before the actual landings took place, Erwin Rommel became commander of Army Group B in northern France. So I'm going to read first a section from the Erwin Rommel page at Wikipedia. I do apologize for that, but I thought it was very good. And I think it gives a very good background of what I think is a good and concise background of what was going on about this expected Allied invasion in northern France. And the German high command knew what to expect, but of course they didn't know when or exactly where, and there was broad disagreement as to how best to meet this. And how to plan for it, and so on. So it says that the commander-in-chief West, Gerd von Rundstedt, believed there was no way to stop the invasion near the beaches due to the firepower possessed by the Allied navies, as had been experienced at Salerno. Gerd von Rundstedt was an older general who was a general in World War I. I'm sure he wasn't just an officer, he was a general, I think. And he was called back by Hitler in World War II, what became World War II. And he was a good general, and he was a good man. He was loyal. He wasn't one of the plotters against Hitler. But he was older, and although I don't think he was wrong here, he was probably more right. He was one of the right ones, but he was the commander-in-chief of West, the whole Western operation, I take it, for the Wehrmacht at that time. So he was the biggest person in the Wehrmacht in the Western operation, and he thought that the firepower, meaning the air power. Firepower possessed by the Allied navies. Oh, I see. Yeah, that's right. The navies at the beaches would make it impossible to stop the invasion. And so he thought that the German armor should be held in reserve well inland near Paris, where they could be used to counterattack in force in a more traditional military doctrine. Well, I was thinking of something else when I said he was right, but this was a reasonable idea to have, and I'll say why, because the Allies could then be allowed to extend themselves deep into France, where a battle for control would be fought, allowing the Germans to envelop the Allied forces in a pincer movement, cutting off their avenue of retreat. These ideas were supported by other officers, most notably Heinz Guderian, the Panzer commander, and the Panzer Group West commander, Leo Geyer, that's spelled G-E-Y-R. These were both loyal men, good men, who were trying to do what they thought was best. And so it says that they feared the piecemeal commitment of their armored forces would cause them to become caught in a battle of attrition, which they could not hope to win. So if they would move their armor, their panzers and their ammunition and so on down closer onto the beach, it could get, it could end up being broken up into little different battles and so on, and they would not then be effective, and they could just end up in a war of attrition where they couldn't even possibly hope to win because they were going to be outmanned and outdone in the materiel in the planes and gunnery and so on, tanks. So the notion of holding the armor inland to use as a mobile reserve force from which they could mount a powerful counterattack applied the classic use of armored formations as seen in France 1940. These tactics were still effective on the Eastern Front, where control of the air was important but did not dominate the action. So this was a tried and true tactic, and a lot of them believed it was the best one. All these men I've mentioned so far thought so, except for Rommel. And they're being used still on the Eastern Front effectively. But it says that control of the air was important on the Eastern Front. Well, it's always important, but it didn't dominate the action. It wasn't the most important thing, and it was going to be turn out to be about the most important thing here in this on the Western Front now and in this invasion. So, on the other side, Rommel's own experience at the end of the North African campaign revealed to him that the Germans would not be allowed to preserve their armor from air attack for this type of massed assault. That is, he believed their only opportunity would be to oppose the landings directly at the beaches and to counterattack there before the invaders could become well established. That is, to prevent them from ever getting a foothold on the continent. Otherwise, it was going to be, he thought, in a sense, too late. Though there had been some defensive positions established and gun emplacements made, the Atlantic Wall was a token defensive line. Rommel believed if the Wehrmacht, Rommel believed if the Wehrmacht would have any chance, beach defenses would have to be created and the forces available brought close enough to the Allied invaders as to make airstrikes against them difficult. So some of this earlier part that I read comes from the book June 1944 by H.P. Wilmot, W-I-L-L-M-O-T-T, and all the way through that to what Heinz Guderian and Leo Gehr thought and how this was being used in the Soviet Union on the Eastern Front. Almost all of that I read was really footnoted, taken from this book by H.P. Wilmot, June 1944. Well, then it goes on to say, upon arriving in northern France, Rommel was dismayed by the lack of completed works and the slow building pace. He feared that he had just a few months before an invasion. His presence greatly invigorated the fortification effort. That means to complete the works, he means on building fortifications at the beaches along the coast there because they didn't know where it would happen, but they were trying to be prepared. And saying that his presence greatly invigorated the fortification effort along the Atlantic Wall comes from this and the next part I'm going to read comes from a book titled Rommel as Military Commander by Ronald Lewin, L-E-W-I-N. Rommel had millions of mines laid and thousands of tank traps and obstacles set up on the beaches and throughout the countryside, including in fields suitable for glider aircraft landings, the so-called Rommel Spargel. Or Rommel's asparagus. Rommel's arrival in northern France instilled a great deal of purpose to the demoralized units that were simply waiting for the inevitable attack. His efforts to buttress the Atlantic Wall went a long way in improving their effectiveness. If given more time, so he improved the effectiveness of the Atlantic Wall that they were trying to create there. And if he had more time, he may have succeeded. But the U.S. Navy commander, Edward Ellsberg, said of the various Atlantic Wall obstacles, this is the U.S. side afterward, said Rommel had thoroughly muddled our plans. Attacking at high tide, as we had intended, we'd never get enough troops in over those obstacles. The obstructions compelled the Allies to land at low tide, which narrowed the time frames that they could, in which they could land and increased the length of the beach to be crossed, but also uncovered and revealed the obstacles, reducing their effectiveness. So of course, everybody's watching and spying and taking photographs and learning what the other side is doing as much as possible. So they knew with the building that was going on there, and they saw how extensive it was, and so they decided they had to land at low tide, they could then see what was on the beach. It wouldn't be covered up by water, and therefore their troops could avoid it, wouldn't have to just run into things they couldn't see. Then von Rundstedt expected the Allies to invade in the Pas-de-Calais, or that is really pronounced Pas-de-Calais, because it was the shortest crossing point from Britain. Its port facilities were essential to supplying a large invasion force, and the distance from Calais to Germany was relatively short. Well, Normandy is in the area where Caen is, and then north of that, to the very far north of the French continent along the Atlantic coast, of the French country, boundaries there along the Atlantic coast is Pas-de-Calais. it is closer to the island of the Britain, but by enough that it would make a difference, I guess. But the British wanted the surprise, so they wanted to do it somewhere where the Germans didn't expect them to do it as much as possible. Of course, the Germans knew pretty much the whole area that they would do it, but in exactly what part, they didn't. They knew that the Germans were expecting them to invade at Pas-de-Calais. Most of them did. I'll just go ahead here. Hitler and his various intelligence services largely agreed with this assessment. Rommel, believing that Normandy was indeed a likely landing ground, argued that it did not matter to the Allies where they landed, just that the landing was successful. So he didn't think that that they would choose Pas-de-Calais over Normandy just because of these benefits, that it was a shorter crossing. It had better port facilities, and it was closer, once they landed, it was closer to Germany, the German borders, than the other. But Rommel disagreed with that, and he always thought it would be Normandy, and he gave those reasons, that it wasn't that important. All these things were not that important, and if the Germans were expecting Pas-de-Calais, then they would not. They were planning it where the Germans didn't expect it as much. So with all this going on, Hitler, according to this Wikipedia, which doesn't have any footnotes in this whole next paragraph here long, I don't know where it's from, but it finally get down to footnote 130, which is Wilmot again, the one June 1944 by Wilmot. So a lot of this may come from there, because it looks like whoever put this together liked this book, which is okay. It's probably pretty accurate. So he says Hitler vacillated between the two strategies. Well, why not? You would, you know, where to place the armor? Where are you going to put what the strategies they're talking about is not where they were going to land, but the strategies of whether to put the armor down on the beach, close to the beach, or keep it back around Paris and wait for the Allies to come in further and then try to have a big, big attack on them. But they've got all those planes, see, and I don't know that the Germans even understood how much air power was going to come with this between the British and the Canadians and the Americans. But it was huge, huge air power. So these strategies, you know, it was he couldn't make up his mind, and he was always, wanting to wait till the last minute he could for any new information or, you know, before he'd make a decision. And there's reasons for that, too, because sometimes you can make a better decision later on and saves the day. You just don't know. These things are all so uncertain. Anyway, in late April, he ordered the 1st SS Panzer Corps placed near Paris, far enough inland, kind of a compromise he did here, far enough inland to be useless to Rommel, but not far enough for von Rundstedt, to make von Rundstedt happy. And right away, Rommel moved those armored formations under his command as far forward as possible. And he ordered General Erich Marx, who was a good guy, M-A-R-C-K-S, who seemed to be a good, loyal commander. He was commanding the 84th Corps. And defending, he was the one that was defending the Normandy section. And Rommel ordered Marx to move his reserves into the front line. So Marx was in the front line with his 84th Corps. Rommel's strategy of the Allies, this is not written right, Rommel's strategy of Allies staged elaborate deceptions for D-Day, giving the impression that the landings would be at Calais. Okay, Rommel's strategy was to stage an elaborate deception, giving the Allies the impression that the landings would be at, that they thought the, what is this? Landings would be at Calais. All right, although Hitler himself expected a Normandy invasion for a while, Rommel and most army commanders in France believed there would be two invasions, with the main invasion coming at Pas-de-Calais. All right, so that's Rommel. See, this was what makes me think that this is coming from different sources, because it doesn't follow. First, Rommel was thought it was going to be at Normandy, and now this says here that that Hitler expected it to be at Normandy, and Rommel and most of the army commanders in France thought there would be two invasions, with the main invasion coming at Pas-de-Calais. So that's probably not exactly accurate. But there was, of course, the expectation that there would be two invasions, and that the first invasion would be a, kind of a feint or a distraction, but it would be enough to make the Germans believe it was the real invasion, and then the real invasion would follow somewhere else when all their forces were. So that is a very good reason why the holding back of the armor and holding back of moving the tank groups around made a lot of sense. They didn't want to send them somewhere, and then it was the wrong place, and then the real thing happened, and they had to backtrack and go all over. So that was part of the reason that we're going to see that they were waiting, continuing to wait in the early hours to see if this was the real deal or not. And again, this is saying, maybe this is repetitive from another source, but Rommel drove defensive preparations all along the coast of northern France, particularly concentrating fortification building in the River Somme estuary. By D-Day, on 6 June 1944, nearly all the German staff officers, including Hitler's staff, believed that Pas-de-Calais was going to be the main invasion site, and continued to believe so even after the landings in Normandy had occurred. A part of the difficulty in the German response to the landings in northern France was the split command structure that was created by Hitler. Anxious of the power of the regular army, that is, you know, not fully trusting the regular army, a second service was created, the Waffen-SS, which was not under command of the regular army, but under Hitler's direct command. That is, the Waffen-SS was set up there in service, that is, in active duty, to be under Hitler's direct command, not under the Wehrmacht's command, which they generally weren't, but sometimes. And this comes from Wilmot. In addition, a great number of the land forces included units under the control of the Luftwaffe, including the paratrooper forces and various flak units, while others were under command of the Kriegsmarine. 14 of the 62 divisions in the West and 7 of the 25 first-grade formations were not part of the army. I repeat that, 14 of the 62 divisions, 62 divisions, that sounds like so much, but it isn't, and 7 of the 25 first-grade formations, those were the most important ones, were not part of the army. That's from Wilmot. And this weakened the ability of the army to control and respond to the battle, somebody else said. Well, the army didn't have control of everything, right? So it couldn't respond with everything that was there. And so you had different commands, which certainly would weaken the ability of the army. But, you know, the things that had happened, and then this is June 6, 1944, and previous to that, and we know what happened on July 20th, 1944. That was the assassination attempt, the big one, that could have very well succeeded and did kill a lot of people. Did kill two officers. One of them was a very favorite officer of Hitler's and did injure a lot of officers and some very badly. That was the Valkyrie operation by all these German Wehrmacht officers who had been plotting this for a long time. They didn't start this after June 6th. They started this long before, and we'll have more on that coming up. But there was a lot to be suspicious about. There's a lot to be worried about because of all the leaks that had taken place on the Eastern Front and had not been solved, who was behind it, the secrets that the Russians knew in advance where the Germans were going to attack, the time, the date, the strength and so on, and they were prepared to respond. And this was a mystery still, where this was coming from. Well, it turned out it was coming from General Feldgebel, who was a chief of the entire communication system at the general headquarters, and he was a very highly thought of officer. He had a perfect record. Nobody suspected him of anything, and he was the one who had the phone system set up, which they finally discovered after July 20th, and was sending things to Sweden, and then that was sent to the Soviets, and all these plans that had finally been finalized, and lots of other things too. So they knew that there were traitors. They knew that there was spies. They knew that there was a problem going on. Hitler knew, but he didn't, as I'm going to say later, he didn't want to suspect his high officers. He thought that was just shameful that they would never, he couldn't suspect that these responsible officers of Germany would be helping the enemy. He just couldn't bring himself to to go there. So now more problems here. To make it worse for Germans, there was a storm on June 5th in the Channel, which seemed to make a landing very unlikely. And everybody agreed, including the meteorologists, that it wouldn't be taking place now until the effects of this storm were gone. And a number of the senior officers were away from their units at this time for training exercises and various other efforts. Well, I think there may have been something else involved with all these officers away than just knowing about the storm. But anyway, we'll see. All this made the German command structure in France in disarray during the opening hours of the D-Day invasion. On June 4th, the chief meteorologist of the 3rd Air Fleet reported that weather in the Channel was so poor there could be no landing attempted for 2 weeks. This is what they said. I guess they did. On June 5th, Rommel then set out to visit his family. Actually, June 6th was his wife's 50th birthday. And so he went to Germany on the 5th to be there for her 50th birthday. And then after that, he was going to go on to Berchtesgaden to meet with Hitler. Now, at this time, Hitler was at Berchtesgaden with all of his staff. Rommel wanted to go there to persuade Hitler that the 12th SS Panzer Division should be moved forward in the St. Lo Carentan area. So he was still worried about those panzers being too far away. He wanted them down there close to the beach. He thought that was the way to go. Turned out he was right, but also because of the other problems that occurred. But several units, notably the 12th SS Panzer, they're repeating themselves. So the one he's wanting to move, the 12th SS Panzer Division and the Panzer Lehr Division, were near enough that they could have caused serious havoc. These were the units that were in reserve, and Hitler was keeping them in reserve, and they were under his control, and they couldn't be released without his permission, and he refused to release these units because he was still concerned over a second landing at the Pas de Calais. So now they're talking about a first landing at Normandy, the landing was taking place at Normandy. Now, and he was now concerned about a second landing at Pas-de-Calais, which would be the main landing. So these units that Rommel wanted to use, and they were close by, the 12th SS Panzer Division and the Panzer Lehr Division, which probably were, they were both under, the 12th anyway was under Hitler's control. I'm not sure about the other one. But Hitler wouldn't release them, and the general command wouldn't release them. So they couldn't be used. However, says here, facing relatively small scale German counterattacks, the Allies quickly secured all beachheads except Omaha. So there wasn't any strong defense there. There wasn't any strong attack from the Germans. They were still holding off. Things hadn't gotten organized. And so while that was during all these night hours, darkness hours, they were quickly securing the beachheads, except they had trouble with Omaha Beach. Rommel personally oversaw the bitter fighting around Caen, where only the determined defense of the Kampfgruppe von Luck prevented a British breakout on the first day. So there was a battle group. Von Luck was down there defending Caen, and that prevented the British from securing that and therefore actually breaking out from the beaches on the first day. Here again, the on-site commanders were denied freedom of action, and the Germans did not launch a concentrated counterattack until midday on June 6th. Well, they like to say that, you know, they were denied freedom of action, blaming it onto Hitler. They always like to do that here in Wikipedia, but this one thing with this 12th SS Panzer Division was not released, and then the other one, another one, I guess, was near, but it couldn't move either, I guess. So not that would have changed everything, but it might have changed quite a bit. But the reasons for it there's a lot of blame to be placed on the military commanders here, and we'll see that. So on, let's see, an impregnable armor supported defense line was scoffed at by most of his fellow commanders, including von Rundstedt. But his support from Hitler and Goebbels meant that he could put all of it into effect except the Panzer divisions. However, these were, in his view, the most critical parts of the plan. So what this part is, this is the end of this section from Wikipedia. It's again, I think, you know, what happens is people come along and add things. And it sometimes disagrees with something else that was there. That's what it seems like to me. But this is saying that that to have an impregnable armor-supported defense line down near the beach was scoffed at, which is what Rommel wanted, was scoffed at by most of all the other commanders, including von Rundstedt, who was the senior commander. But that Hitler had support, I mean, Rommel had support from Hitler and Goebbels, for whatever that means, except for that... the Panzer divisions, the SS Panzer divisions. He had support in whatever he wanted to do otherwise. And these were, in his view, the most critical parts of the plan. For Rommel, the most critical parts of the plan was to have those Panzer divisions, was to put them. So there was just a lack of consensus and meeting of mind here that made what was done not effective. I'm now going to go to a little paragraph here, a couple paragraphs about from somewhere else, that how the Germans, it's headed, Germans are taken by surprise. And it talks about where all these officers were who weren't there with their units at the time this was taking place. And Rommel's, you need to know that Rommel's headquarters in northwest France were in a place called La Roche-Guyon. And that was a big, you know, impressive, huge building, like a palace or something that they had taken over, or a big chateau or something. And that's where Rommel's headquarters was. And from there, he was to defend Normandy against the Allies. So back at La Roche-Guyon, we're going to find Hans Speidel. But in the meantime, General Edgar Feuchtinger, the commander of the 21st Panzer Division, the most powerful striking force in Germany, was missing on D-Day morning. His aides believed that he was with his French mistress. And then I ask, you know, could she have been with the resistance? And a whole lot of these people could have been with the resistance and making themselves friendly with German officers. But again, if this was a time when it was said that because of the weather in the channel, and because of the storm and so on, that definitely this was not going to be, there's not going to be a landing at this time, they may have, you know, decided to use that as to go and take a little free time for themselves and do something that they might not have otherwise done. Don't know, but he was, now this 21st, he comes in later, this 21st No, that's the 12th Panzer Division. So I don't know. The 21st Panzer Division is not the 12th. Don't want to get those mixed up. And he was not the only senior German commander caught not in his place. Rommel, as we've already said, went on this trip to spend the day with his wife on her birthday, and then was going to go on. So he did not get back until the afternoon. And his chief of staff, General Hans Speidel, now this is the worst of all, he was having drinks on the evening of the 5th and on into midnight. I think they had a dinner there at the La Roche-Guyon place, impressive chateau, with his fellow anti-Hitler plotters. And they spend a lot of hours together discussing their plot. This was, of course, the headquarters of Army Group B that this was taking place in. So Hans Speidel, whether you think he was, he was responsible for a lot of what happened, of the problems on D-Day, he definitely was a traitor who was from the very beginning in on this. Officers, I mean, they tried something earlier before Hitler did the Munich Pact. They wanted to get rid of Hitler all the way back then. And they were always looking for opportunities. Then they changed their mind because Hitler had done something that turned out really good. And then he was so popular, and so then they'd give up on it for a while. But they were always in contact with one another, basically, sort of. And they always had these ideas that they knew better. So that's what he was doing, and he went to bed very late because people didn't leave until around midnight. And he was sleeping through quite a bit of it. Not really. They woke him up. And then another general, Friedrich Dohlmann, the 7th Army commander, decided to go off with his senior officers for a map exercise in Rennes, and they, or Ren, might be pronounced, and he relaxed the standing alert for his men on the beach defenses. Now, he was down there on the beach, there was all those defense machine gun emplacements and so on. And they were on alert, but it was a more relaxed alert, and he was gone, too, on this thing. And then it says in Paris, Gerd von Rundstedt, the commander-in-chief West, was located in Paris. And this writer says he was not interested when he was told that German radar stations between Cherbourg and Le Havre were being jammed and the BBC was transmitting many coded messages to the French resistance. It's true. He was told that and he thought it didn't mean anything. Says that he was sure that the Allies would strike. So he was so sure that the Allies would strike at Pas-de-Calais that neither the airborne drops nor the beach landings changed his mind. Well, once again, they were thinking this was a diversion. This wasn't the real thing because they wouldn't be doing this here or whatever for whatever reasons. Because they did so many of them, they thought there's going to be two. There's going to be the first one that's not real, and then. But see, the intelligence of this, the Allies also know what the Germans are going to be thinking. They know what all military people think. Military people know what other military people are thinking, and so if they know that the Germans would kind of expect that there would be a diversion and then there would be the real thing, well then they would just do the real thing right away and let the Germans think that it was a diversion, which is exactly what happened. So you have to wonder about how alert anybody was. It's like they had all gone to sleep and they didn't, I don't know, maybe that's what happens when you're expecting something's going to happen, but you don't know what and you don't know when and you've been preparing for a long time. You get kind of numb to it maybe. But in any case, now we're at Berchtesgaden and Hitler was awakened at 9 a.m. because he had gone to bed at 3 a.m. the night before, which is common with him because he had insomnia, and he would stay up and try to talk to people and, you know, chit-chat and relax so that he could get these problems off his mind so that he could sleep. He'd even get a little bit of a sleeping potion. And often he fell asleep and then he'd wake up again. But if he was sleeping, they didn't want to wake him. And then they thought they knew what he would do. So I don't even want to say this. It sounds so horrible. Hitler issued an order at 4:55 p.m. because we're going to go into that a little bit later. When he got up and they told him about it, and they told him what they had done, especially Jodl, he agreed with what Jodl had done, which was to keep holding back that reserve Panzer Division. So Jodl was happy that Hitler thought he did the right thing. And it took a while for the seriousness of all this to somehow hit people. So at this point, I'm going to go into more about Hans Speidel. In the New York Times obituary, of course, there's his Wikipedia page, too, for just basic facts. But in April 1944, he became chief of staff to Field Marshal Erwin Rommel when Rommel went to France and he was transferred. He had been chief of staff for a couple of other high-level generals, but now he was transferred to Rommel. Well, I think he had been, April 44. Don't take me, I'm not sure if he was with Rommel before that or not, but I'd have to go back and look at those pages. But in any case, he was at this time. And he had become so disillusioned with Hitler, and it led him into conversations with other senior officers who were plotting a bold revolt against Hitler. Yeah, that's what the New York Times says. And General Speidel was assigned by the plotters to persuade Rommel to join in, possibly to become head of the revolutionary government if the conspiracy succeeded. So I don't know if anybody had anything to do with him becoming Rommel's chief of staff. For this very purpose, because there are a lot of German generals and even field marshals or one or two field marshals, or at least one, and high officers involved in this. And some lower, not so high officers were involved in it too. And so Speidel was he wasn't loyal to the regime, and these people were willing to help the enemy too, which they did a lot of. It was found out they did a lot of helping the enemy. So he was assigned. Then he was given the job, or maybe he decided it himself. Who knows? Because you don't know how this stuff is written, or what these people know who write it. But he was working on Rommel, but carefully. He told Rommel about the plot, and he told, or that what they wanted to do, and he told Rommel, gave him information about death camps, and told him about all that stories that they had, and Rommel was shocked by that and so on. But Rommel had not decided to go along with them. But the thing was, Rommel knew, and he didn't then warn Hitler or warn anybody. He knew and just let it sit there. He wasn't going to tell on them, obviously. They said that maybe they had considered he might become head of the government if they succeeded in doing this. So this is another story, of course, the Valkyrie assassination plot, but it fits in with the people who were involved in that, were involved on both fronts, and some of them were on the Western Front, and they could very well have been passing information to the Allies. I don't see why they wouldn't have been. Why wouldn't they have contacts in the intelligence service would be, you know, getting people to contact them, spies, and talking to them, and they would be able to pass on some of this vital information, like what the Germans were thinking about the invasion and what they were expecting, and so on and so forth. I think that's very likely. Well, and then this Speidel, who we'll talk about a little more later, in 1957, he survived. You know, he wasn't even put on trial by the Allies. They just freed him. And because he had been put in prison at the end because of the July 20th plot, it was suspected that he was a part of it, but they never were able to prove it against him. He was the only one that they couldn't get on. He was a very smart man, but I'll get into that in a minute. He was allowed to just go free, and he worked as a professor in a university because he had a doctorate degree. And in 1957, he was named commander of the Allied Forces Central Europe, one of the most important posts in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And later, he became, where is that at? He became the NATO commander, the first German to become the NATO commander. He served in this NATO post, until 1963, when he was replaced by another German general. And in 1930, he had been appointed. He was a lifelong military man. He joined the army after he turned 17, 2 months after the outbreak of World War I. He became a junior officer, and some people thought he did very well, and he was encouraged to study. And in 1930 he was appointed to the general staff. So he was a professional soldier officer, but he wasn't much of a person in battle. He was always working for the general staff. But in World War II, he became a military attaché in Paris, and he developed a strong affection for the French, and he played a key role. Well. This is what happens with these military attachés who go and serve in certain other capitals. They get to really like these people. And I talked about this on a table talk program. Boy, look at some of the hours almost up, and I haven't even gotten very far here. I'm chatting too much. He thought he was very intelligent, high class, and he just wasn't a Hitler type. He wasn't a National Socialist type. And so they all went along with it when Hitler was doing so many good things for Germany, adding the German territory back. They were all totally against Weimar and what happened during after World War I. And they thought of themselves as loyal German nationalists and so on. But they only went so far with it. They only wanted to get back so much, and then they didn't want to do any more. And Germany, okay, I'll stop with that. Now, I'm going to see where that comes in. All right, not yet. Now, here's some information from his Wikipedia page that... when Rommel was wounded, boy, this is after D-Day, Rommel was wounded in an air attack on his staff. Speidel continued as chief of staff for the new commander of Army Group B, Field Marshal Gunther von Kluge. Now, Gunther von Kluge was another one of these traitors and a big, big presence in the plot. So, He replaced Rommel. Rommel really got caught in a web of of treason, and he didn't really want to be there, but he didn't. He was an honorable man, and they were telling him all this information about death camps and stuff, and that was affecting him. But in any case, I'm going to jump ahead here. Say that Speidel was a German nationalist. They call him a German nationalist, even always. But he was supposedly appalled by Hitler's racial policy. So what kind of German nationalist are you if you want to keep Jews in Germany? Wouldn't any German nationalist know my brain went dead. Any would know what damage Jews were doing in Germany, but no, they couldn't deal with that because they wanted to be in favor with the rest of the world. They wanted to fit in with all the rest of the world, these other major countries. They wanted to be, you know, in good standing. They wanted to be respectable and all of that. So they couldn't tolerate. They had to tolerate the Jews because they couldn't tolerate doing anything about it. But, you know, he was arrested after the July 20th assassination plot. Eventually, they got to him. The Gestapo supposedly arrested 5,000 people and interrogated them and so on. But he was the only one of the entire inner circle of this assassination plot who did not lose his life because the Gestapo was not able to get him to say anything, and nobody said anything about him, and he didn't say anything, supposedly. But recent documentation found in Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery's papers at London's Imperial War Museum reveal a deposition made by Manfred Rommel, Rommel's son, in Württemberg on 27 April 1945. That was before the end of the war, not too much before, but long before the circumstances of Erwin Rommel's death were public knowledge. And Manfred, in this deposition, recounted the circumstances of his father's death and suicide, specifically that my father's former chief of general staff, Lieutenant Colonel Speidel, who had been arrested a few weeks before, had stated that my father had taken a leading part in the 20th July 1944 plot and had only been prevented from direct cooperation by his injuries. Because, as I already said, I hope I made that clear, after the after D-Day, but before I remember now, it was the 17th of July, 1944. Rommel was driving. He was being driven in a kind of a motorcade thing, not a motorcade, but a group of cars, and they were going around checking out different things in the area there, and his car was strafed, a British plane, maybe a mosquito or something, strafed them, and the car got into an accident. He was thrown out, and he had these serious head injuries, and he was in the hospital. And that was just a few days, see, before the plot was to take place. So he wasn't there. He wasn't involved, or they say he would have been. Speidel said, according to Rommel's son, Speidel said that his father would have been involved, would have been cooperating with it directly. But otherwise, there wasn't anything else. And this Speidel was imprisoned by the Gestapo, but he wasn't hanged like the others. Now, where have I got that part? I guess I have to wait till I get to that. He appeared before an army court of honor, but the army represented, there's three people, von Rundstedt, Guderian and Wilhelm Keitel. Now, Wilhelm Keitel was the general staff right under Hitler. And we know who the other two are. And they refused to expel him from the German army. They just couldn't find enough evidence that he should have been, you know, that he had done anything wrong. Although he definitely had, but they couldn't find the evidence. So because they wouldn't expel him from the German army, he didn't have to appear before the People's Court, where he would have gotten a death sentence, they say. But he was, I don't know what they had on him by that time, but anyway, he wasn't, he remained in prison. And when the Allies approached the location where he was held, he slipped away from his captors and he went into hiding. And then he was freed by French troops on 29th April 1945. Now, that's before the end of the war. 29th of April is 2 days before that, that Manfred Rommel made his deposition against Speidel. But he was the only, they freed him. They just freed him. The French troops just freed him. They must have known him, huh? Well, they knew him, but why did they just free him? That's what they did. So now I'm going to go to this magazine, Barnes Review, for something that one of our Ayn and Hitler articles. This is in the November-December 2009 issue, and it is one of the Valkyrie installments, the third one out of four, the final plot against Hitler, which is all talking about the traitors. And we did a, and you can find that at, you can't find this sidebar because I'm going to have to add it. I did not add it to what's on my website, to the, there's a few sidebars from here, from what were in the, that were in the magazine that never got added to what I put on, to the transcripts and that. I know the actual text articles that were that I have on my website under Ayn and Hitler. So this one is not there, and I'm going to read what this sidebar says. It says Speidel, the man who lost D-Day, General Hans Speidel above, pictured above, Valkyrie conspirator and chief of staff of Army Group B under Erwin Rommel, and then under Gunther von Kluge, below, he's pictured below right, was in one of the most commanding spots at the Normandy invasion front. He continued to tell Okave to hold back divisions because the landing location was not certain. Now, Okave was Keitel and Jodl, and with Hitler there, too, that was the highest, the supreme command of the army and of the armed forces, I should say. And he is the one when they, you know, he continued to send the message to them to hold back divisions because the landing location was not certain. And he never said otherwise. And so Spanish super spy for Germany, Alcazar de Velasco, said after the war, quote, "It's because of him, Speidel, we lost the war," unquote. Speidel survived to become a four-star general in charge of NATO. I already told you about that. And NATO land forces Middle Europe. And Stupnagel, who I don't think we've come to him yet. He was military chief of France, a slightly different position than the other twos. And he was, his job in Valkyrie was to arrest the SS command post in Paris. And he, I'm going to read this story here, but I've got it, I don't have to read it in the magazine because I've got it here. This is called Treason in the West, and this is how it played out. Conspirator Lieutenant Colonel Caesar von Hoffacker, officer on the staff of General Karl Heinrich von Stupnagel, military chief of France, received a call from Stauffenberg at 4 o'clock in the afternoon telling him Hitler was dead. Now, in February 1942, Stupnagel was made the German-occupied France's military commander. And in this position, he, along with his personal advisor, Lieutenant Colonel Caesar von Hoffacker, joined the July 20th plot. So he received Stauffenberg, because he was in cahoots with that. One of the things that Stauffenberg wanted to do was to notify Stupnagel that Hitler, that the plot had succeeded and Hitler was dead. And then it was Stupnagel was going to order that the these SS units be arrested. That was part of how to then they were going to take over and so on. But the thing with Stauffenberg is that even though information had already come out that Hitler was not dead, he wouldn't believe it. You talk about these military officers who won't believe what they're told because they think it's some kind of a trick or a lie, and they've got it fixed in their mind that it's something else. Hitler's the only one that's accused of that, but they are all like that. At one time or another, that they just couldn't they couldn't process information that they didn't want to process. So based on this information from Stauffenberg's, Stupnagel did issue the order to arrest members of the SS command post in Paris, according to the Valkyrie plan, and Field Marshal Gunther von Kluge's chief of staff, General Speidel, got the call from Stupnagel's chief of staff, General Blumentritt, but decided to wait for Kluge to return from the front. So the arrest of around 120 members of the SS took place before two Waffen-SS generals were informed of this, and a Navy attachment was alarmed enough to warn of armed intervention unless the SS prisoners were released. And by that time, radio and telephone and, you know, every other form of communication was revealing that Hitler was alive. So that's when the whole thing fell apart. But here you've got all these people who were the, okay, I always have to go back and find what they're, head of the military chief of France, Stupnagel, his chief of staff, Hoffacker, and General Speidel, who is the chief of staff of Rommel, and General Blumentritt, who is the chief of staff of von Kluge, all involved in this plot to kill Hitler. I'm going to get back to the D-Day, but this is just to show these people were all involved in D-Day because they're all there, the high-level people in the West. And von Kluge was involved in D-Day, maybe not as directly as some of the others. And then von Kluge returned to headquarters. This is an interesting story. At 6 p.m., and summoned Stupnagel and General Sperle, Blumentritt and Speidel. Sperle is another one who was involved in this, to report to him. And during the following 2 hours, they shared a tense but civil dinner until a call from General Stief at Okaha gave the definite word that Hitler was alive and any action taken on Stauffenberg's Valkyrie, Valkyrie plan, was madness. That you know, it was over. Quit. Don't act on it. So now General Stief he was in the general staff too. He was kind of an organizer. He wasn't in combat. He organized events and so on that were needed to be taking place. He was that real small guy, real short. So they were all involved in this. You have to wonder just how involved in the failure of D-Day how involved they were in assuring that. And that's why I brought up earlier that that I think it's very likely that Speidel was passing on whatever information he knew. Well, I've got more to say here, so I better hurry along. Now Hitler, here's some, I do want to add this. This is a conversation from Adolf Hitler, according to Hermann Giesler, about what occurred afterwards. Afterwards, Hitler was thinking about it. It bothered him that all these people, all these officers of his, wanted to kill him. And he said to Giesler, "Those were the worst days of my life. How easy and simple it would be for me to terminate my life. What is my life? Added to all those disappointments, only struggle and worry and grinding responsibility." But then he says that he's talking about, he believes that fate assigned him to do this work that he's doing. And he says, "If our struggle is to make sense, we must succeed in exterminating the bearers of that treason, because all our efforts, all the efforts, all the bravery are in vain against treason within your own people." And I believe he's thinking about all the bravery of the soldiers and all the effort of the good people in the military and of the people at home and all the German people, all sacrificing and working toward this. It's all in vain. All the work that people do is in vain when there's treason within your own people. They destroy it all. I agree with that 100%. "How malicious and wretched is that treason," he said. "I could sense it through all the years, but struggled with myself to believe that German officers, generals, could be connected with it. Beyond any imagination is treason during a war, treason against the nation, and treason against the fighting soldiers." That's what bothered him the most. He says, "I believed that I could win them over since the existence of Germany was at risk." He knew that a lot of these generals didn't like him. But he said he thought he could win them over since it was Germany. It was about Germany, and Germany was at stake. But they had a different picture of that, see? And he said even Europe was, the existence of even Europe was at risk. And he says, "I stood up to overcome Marxism and introduced instead a socialism of a unified nation, Volksgemeinschaft, in other words. I did win the workmen, but I misjudged the reactionary." Speaking of these old, powerful, aristocratic types or upper-class types. "They were here, in the Reichswehr, within industry, the powerful economic and money circles. They were here, too, as failed politicians and diplomats. I misjudged their vain ambitions, their need for admiration, and their intellectual shortcomings. All that I misjudged." I guess admiration from the rest of the world and admiration from the other people of their own rank and standing in other countries, all of that things that people want and need. And he said, "I forgot to get rid of those fossils of a long past era. In a time of urgency, reconstruction, reformation, war requirements, and burdening pressure, I forgot that I am a revolutionary." Well, he had so much to do, so much to take care of, and that he started, he's saying that he depended on the people who could do it, who were experienced and who knew what they were doing, and put that over and above the revolutionary aspect. And he says that that someone from the reactionary group might at some time shoot at me. I thought about that and had to live with it. But I never believed it possible that a general staff officer was able to commit such a characterless crime, that is to try to kill the leader and pass secrets to the enemy, even though, due to my experiences since 1938, I had to expect all that. They didn't have the courage to openly resist me or shoot me. And then he says, "We have to create a new aristocracy, a value and rank order based on character, courage, and steadiness." And he says, one sentence of Nietzsche's I identify with, which is, quote, "What today can prove if one be of value or not, that he is steadfast." You know, so often people think of Hitler's tendency to not want to retreat to not want to give up anything that they've gained, you know, to see it as a rigidness. But I do think it's in large part his idea of being steadfast. And he had Frederick the Great as his example, which he depended on. Because Frederick the Great, as I mentioned recently, somewhere else, had been at the point of defeat a couple of times. And then by somehow not giving up and still fighting, trying to fight on, things turned and he ended up victorious. And this is why Hitler was so unwilling to ever give up. He just didn't believe in giving up because then you really have lost, you know, that kind of a thing. Well, anyway, this is in the article, The Final Plot Against Hitler, which you can find on my website under the Valkyrie series, under Ein Anderer Hitler. So now I'm at this place that I want to read something that I think is helpful. I don't know if I made my case against Speidel. You might know that the German who lost D-Day that I'm thinking about in the title of this program is Speidel, and that has been said by certain people. I want to emphasize one more time, if I didn't get it across, that he was in the commanding position, or he was in the perfect position to do the most damage. And just like Feldgebel was back on the Eastern Front, where he was always with the general staff, but wherever they went, they were in those, you know, in those bunkers, headquarter bunkers, during much of that time. And he was running the communication system, and he was giving away all these secrets. He was in the perfect place to do that, and nobody suspected him. And now we had Speidel, who had an equally admirable record. He had high marks. He had even won he had a Knight's Cross and all of that, not for battle, but because of all the good work he had done for as chief of staff for these generals and field marshals, his service. I don't know why he'd get that, but he did. Maybe showing leadership or something. But he was in the perfect spot there to cause the Allies to know things that would help them, and to kind of create more disarray amongst the German officers. And some of this will come out now, so let me go on here and try to get through this as much as I can. I have to go to I'm going to look at my email in case somebody's sending something that I should see. No, I don't see anything. Okay, I'm going to now go to another page. And this is something, I don't know, it's a whole long bunch of stuff about D-Day. And it says on this is the page, it's the D-Day Countdown, the German Perspective, on Tuesday, June 6, 1944. And it has, in the URL, it has the name Andrew.Etherington, if he wrote it, or I don't know, but I thought it was good. And I saw it referred to at the Axis History Forum, and I was going to take it from there. And then there was a link, and I came to here. So, and I read the whole thing, and so I'm just going to read. And from what I've already talked about, I shouldn't have to, add any explanation or anything like that always slows me down so much. So, now, I'm just going to start here, and there's some interesting information, and just gives you a picture of what the situation was. And so it starts at midnight on June 6th, which is, you know, like 0 hour or one minute or something into the 24 hours. And it says thousands of Allied aircraft swarm towards thousands. Did anybody expect so many? I don't think so. Thousands of Allied aircraft swarm towards the northwestern coast of France. Excuse me. Following the routes the pathfinders have taken an hour ago. From the northwest come planes carrying the advanced elements of the American 101st and 82nd Airborne Divisions. From the northeast come paratroops of the British 6th Airborne. On the ground, thousands of French resistance make their contribution to the war effort. Thousands of French resistance members were in cities all over northern France begin experiencing caused cities all over northern France to begin experiencing communications problems. They were highly involved in sabotage on this day, starting at this point, and so that they could break up. And there were some communication problems too, which would be due to them. At 12:15 a.m., that means 15 minutes after midnight, an hour after the pathfinders and the dummies have arrived, the airborne troops are jumping into France. The overcast gray-black skies fill with hundreds of silk shoots as they fall into the dark of night. Spital's party finally breaks up after midnight, the one I told you about. His guests finally thin out. At 1 a.m., he turns to go to bed. Admiral Ruge decides to stay up for a while. He was there also, and he's another one who's in on it. Just after 2:09 a.m., a couple of the surviving German radar stations are seeing large areas of snow all over their screens for a good part of the night. There appears to be two very large bomber groups heading for Germany, and a number of vessels have been picked up by surface radar, apparently headed for Le Havre. In the next hour, these contacts turned out to be a hoax as they disappeared back into the English coastline. But now one of the repaired radar sets has picked up a large number of ships in position off the Normandy shoreline. Naval Group West in Paris is contacted. Now, I don't know what to make of this supposed hoax, because there were bombers heading for Germany. I see, heading for Germany. Well, I don't know if that was actually a hoax or they just did something to make it go away and then they thought it was a hoax, because they're always expecting hoaxes. But in any event, I'll go on. General Marx is at his headquarters in St. Lô. Remember I mentioned General Marx. He plays a key role here. He's a good guy, though. The quick, modest birthday celebration given to him at midnight by his staff is now over, and he is wrapping up his plans for tomorrow's Kriegsspiel at Rennes. Okay, he was going to be a part of that war games thing with the other, with that other general who had left. But there are other things to explore, like all these enemy aircraft flying slowly overhead. Airborne troops? Probably. At 1:10 a.m., he gets a call from the operations chief of the 716th Division headquarters in Caen. Now, Caen is there in along, close to the Normandy beach. It's in that area. Mark's whole body stiffens as he is told of airborne landings east of the Orne estuary around Ranville. 1:10 a.m. The enemy objectives appear to be the dives and Orne River bridges. After a moment of silence, Mark's intelligence officer tells him, "Sir, this is the invasion." So Mark puts his corps on alert and contacts Pemcel at Le Mans. Max Pemcel, I don't know what his role was in this D-Day. He was good, bad, or indifferent. But the other, he was the other German officer from the NS period, along with Speidel, who joined the Bundeswehr and was a member in 1956, and he became a general lieutenant in the Bundeswehr. So he and Speidel were the ones who went on to have careers in the modern German army and involved with NATO and all that stuff. But I know more about Speidel than I do about this Pemcel. But where was I? Where'd that go? I can't even find. Oh, there it is. Over the next 5 hours, they plot the landing reports and issue orders, but in their minds, they have no doubts about what is happening and where the landing will be. After a brief rest, Spidle is woken up and told about the airborne reports. He notifies all major commands. Reports now coming are perplexing and often contradictory. Some are illogical. Not having a clear picture yet, he decides to wait and see what develops. It will pretty much be his drill for the whole night. That means he's going to continue to think that we better wait and see what develops. But he's not the only one. By 1:30 a.m., reports are reaching General von Salmuth at 15th Army Headquarters in Tourcoing. Supposedly, enemy paratroopers were landing near the 711th Headquarters at Cabourg on the coast, and that fighting was going on all around the buildings. To von Salmuth, this sounds crazy. His army was on full alert, and enemy air raids were hitting Calais, but nothing much else seemed to be going on. So he calls Reichert at Caen. Finally getting through, he growls, "Reichert, what the devil is going on down there?" Well, now this is where these reports were, that fighting was going on around the building. And Reichert replies plaintively, "My general, if you'll permit me, I'll let you hear for yourself." Von Salmuth waits a moment, listening sullenly, his eyes rolling upwards. Suddenly, he distinctly hears from the receiver machine gun fire in the background. "Thank you," he promptly responds and hangs up. He calls Spidle and tells him that at the headquarters of the 711th, the din of battle can be heard. Now, the 711th was at Cabourg on the coast. Well, I didn't look that one up, but it is on the coast, so probably in Normandy, the Normandy coast, because that's where the actual action was taking place. Then O.B. West, and O.B. West is considered the entire Western command, first gets the word at 1:23 a.m. about the paratroop landings from Naval Group West, and that 134th Corps is on full alert. Now, Blumentritt and von Rundstedt are woken up at their villa. Blumentritt is von Rundstedt, his chief of staff. They monitor, I mean, he's in on the plot, though, but von Rundstedt is not. So von Rundstedt doesn't know what his chief of staff is up to. They monitor the incoming messages for the next 3 hours, before von Rundstedt decides that it is time to bring up the panzers. So now von Rundstedt, around 4 a.m., wants to take action. And he orders Panzer Group West at 4:25 to reconnoiter in force into 711th Division Sector. Keeping Okave informed, they first call and inform them of what they are doing, which is what they're supposed to do. That's where Jodl is, with Hitler at Berchtesgaden, then follow up with a message at 4:45, formally requesting that the Panzer reserves be released. Now, you know, it's still dark, although it's not, it's going to be light pretty soon. It's June. And these groups are already starting to move. When Jodl at Okave refuses to release the panzers. These two panzer groups, the 12th SS and the Panzer Group Lehr, and he learns about it. Once he hears about it, he refuses to release them. He wants to wait and see what develops. Von Rundstedt is infuriated, throws his hands up in disgust, and walks outside. So it was mostly Rommel, once he got in on the action, he's back in Germany, you know, for his wife's birthday, and von Rundstedt, who wanted to take action soon, but the rest of them wanted to wait. And again, you can understand if they thought that there was going to be, you know, if there was going to be a fake invasion, then there'd be the real invasion. Then they should wait. But this was a decision that the people were seemed to be too disconnected to be able to figure out and make this decision. It was all very disconnected, also because so many people were missing, and they had been told that that it wouldn't take place at this time because of the weather. So around 2:50 a.m., Admiral Theodore Cranke is awakened in his hotel room in Bordeaux by a phone call. It's from Admiral Hennecke. Now, these are two admirals, and they're communicating. Hennecke in Cherbourg reports that airborne landings are occurring in the Normandy area, close to the Saint-Marcouf Naval Battery, and Cranke tells him to alert his forces, tells Hennecke to alert his forces. Cranke then calls for an update from his headquarters in Paris and orders a full alert and naval sortie, then makes immediate arrangements to return. He'll get there around noon. So I guess he's down there in Bordeaux having a vacation or something, or maybe he's there for some good purpose. But he did the right thing. He took some action. At 3:15, General Craze, commanding the 352nd Infantry Division, summons his regimental commanders, telling them about the airborne drops. He turns to Oberst Meyer, who was commanding 1,700 men in his reserve regiment, the 915th. He orders Meyer to lead his men away from Bayeux, a locality, a French place in France, and probe inland behind the division's left for paratroopers. That is, I don't know what the left refers to there, but he's supposed to go and look for paratroopers who may have landed somewhere around there. The companies would have to load up, some by tired old French trucks, some on confiscated bicycles, and many simply on foot, there to head towards the Cerisy Forest. Now, one thing is critical, though, Christ adds. This is General Christ. If Meyer's men do not meet any real resistance, maybe some French resistance people or something, but any real resistance, and the invasion comes, they're supposed to return as fast as possible to augment the men on the coast. So Meyer is supposed to stay in contact with the division, radio contact with division headquarters, and he acknowledges that and promises he'll stay in touch. So he goes off with these 1,700 men, and it says it takes him an hour to move all of his men out. And once they're gone, he gets lost. He got lost. He didn't stay in contact. And now it doesn't explain why, if there was some good reason. Therefore, vital reserves were withheld from the beachfront defenses for many hours. Now, why would this guy get lost, and why would he not stay in radio contact? Unless there was a good reason, maybe he was doing this on purpose. But nothing is said about it, so I guess he had excuses to give. By 3:40, Max Pemsel, that I already mentioned, is filtering messages that come into the 7th Army headquarters. A major airborne drop has come down along the Orne River on the right, and another has landed over on the left near the Vire and Meride rivers. Marx is probably right, they consider. Chances are the landing will be on the coast somewhere in the middle, on the Normandy coast. A dispatch is passed to Pemsel. Communications have been lost with Saint-Mère Eglise. Now, if communications were lost with this place, it could have been the work of the French resistance. That's what they were busy doing, trying to destroy as much of the communication as they could. So now we go to Berchtesgaden. It's about 5:45 a.m. The birds are just starting to sing. So it's daybreak, and at Jodl's headquarters there, von Rundstedt's message notifying them that he is releasing the Panzers has been received. He's also received a number of calls from General Warlamont on the other side of town. I assume that means Paris. Yeah, General Warlamont was in Paris. Not sure at all of what is going on, what is going to be landed and where. Jodl decides to hold off releasing the reserve Panzers, knowing that this is what the Fuhrer would do, and reserving for him the option of letting them go. So, at OB West, that's Rundstedt, they're mad as hell. He's very mad. Jodl knows he's mad as hell, but he thinks that's just too bad. These Panzers divisions are the Fuhrer's to use, or these Panzers in this division are the Fuhrer's, and it will be his choice as to whether they go into combat or wait and see what's going on, because this could be a ruse. If von Rundstedt wants to go over his head, over Jodl's head, let him wake Hitler up. Well, Jodl doesn't want to wake Hitler up because they figure he'd be crabby. but, you know, that he needs to get some sleep to deal with all of this, and they don't think there's anything that he can do at the moment. That's really the reason. I mean, if they thought they needed to wake him up, they would have. But they didn't think there was a real necessity. And it turned out, according to Hitler, there wasn't. So at the Berghof, although if he'd been up longer, he might have been able to get more information earlier, take it all in earlier. But Hitler's naval aide is Admiral von Puttkamer, and he's been told about the airborne drops. But he doesn't know whether to wake Hitler up because he's only had a few hours of sleep. Well, yeah, that's right. So, and it talks about Hitler's insomnia, which I already spoke about. And so Puttkamer decides not to wake Hitler up and tells himself that, or tells somebody that there isn't much to tell him anyway. They just don't think there's good enough reason to do it. By now, the Allied fleet and Air Force has pummeled the target beaches, and thousands of Allied troops are hitting the shores of Normandy. D-Day has come. It is quiet at the Rommel House in Hurlingen. Well, we talk here about the field marshal is up early, but his son and wife are still asleep, and he's looking over her birthday presents. He doesn't know a thing yet. He's telling the servants to bring flowers into the house from the fields, and he's gathering his wife's presents. And around 6:20 a.m., he's finally called by this damn Speidel, his chief of staff. 6:20 a.m., the phone rings. So, again, they don't want to wake him up or bother him. Rommel answers it. It's Speidel at La Roche-Guyon. Rommel goes numb as his chief of staff reports that some sort of an attack has been made. There have been a number of airborne drops in the Normandy area. Speidel concluded that he was not sure whether or not this was just a Dieppe-type raid, possibly to divert their attention. You know, I haven't, I don't have any calls, no. Okay. Look at this. Get rid of that tab. Or the actual invasion. They don't know whether it's, you know, again, he just can't make up his mind. And Rommel replies tersely, well, find out, and fast. Rommel is thinking an invasion in lousy weather. Can it be? And Rommel calls Lang and tells him to pack. Lang is an assistant of him because in this picture I used for this program, it's got Speidel and Rommel in front and then this face in behind them, in between, and he's called Lang. He's named as Lang. So Lang is somebody who is an assistant of Rommel's. I don't know he's a general of some kind. He calls him and tells him to pack because they might have to go back. And he, in the meantime, Speidel calmly calls Tempelhof in Munich. Well, that's where they write it here. He calmly calls. He's calm the whole time. What we're going to find out here, in case I run out of time, is that Rommel, that Speidel, is always calm. He's unperturbed. He's not ruffled. Other people are getting very angry. They're upset. They're anxious. They're trying to find out information. They want to do the right thing. But Speidel doesn't seem to be bothered by anything. This is very suspicious to me. Because if you care about something, you're going to show it. If for him, it may be that everything's going along swimmingly, just the way he wanted it to be. So the 21st Panzer Division, which was alerted since midnight, and has been on alert since midnight, and now it's 6-something in the morning, over 6 hours later, and now they're ordered to move toward their jump-off points against the enemy. They're probably all worn out. They, you know, had no sleep. They should have been allowed to sleep. But anyway, they've been on the alert, and the target is the British paratroopers on the east bank of the Orne, holding the two bridges near Burnville. The 21st units are awaiting Fuchtinger's word, to advance. So in addition to the units mobilized and ready on the coast, three full panzer divisions are thought to be on their way into the troubled area. Unfortunately, nobody remembers General Pickert and the rest of his third flak corps, on the other side of the Seine in Paris. The flak units would not get the word until mid-afternoon. You think they need those flak units there? Yes. But no, somebody missed the ball there, and they didn't get there until mid-afternoon. 8 a.m., General Fuchtinger is mad as hell. He and his men had just begun to engage the British. Now, they were sent off to where the British paratroopers were on the east bank of the Orne. But now, they had just begun to engage the British on the east bank of the Orne. Now it was all for nothing. He had just gotten off the phone with General Marx, and General Marx had told him that his Panzer Corps had been made a part, been put under Marx's command, and Fuchtinger was now to turn his entire division around and go back to Cannes, which is probably a traffic madhouse by now, he thought, because it was being threatened by the British landing on the beaches. And he was to advance toward the British beachhead and crush it. That beachhead, Marx tells him, is the highest priority. The paratroopers will have to wait until later. Fuchtinger snidely pointed out to Marx that somebody has to keep the airborne troops at bay. Marx agrees with that. And reconsidering, he allows Fuchtinger to leave behind one Panzer Reconnaissance Company, or Recon Company, from the 22nd Panzer Regiment. Fuchtinger does leave one, but he also decides to leave von Luck's 125th Panzer Grenadier Regiment behind as well, because he wants to take care of those paratroopers landing there. No matter what, a lot of time will be wasted as the rest of the division moves back southeast to Cannes, because, you know, This is so infuriating to think about this, where it will cross the river and the canal and then move up along the west bank toward the beachhead. Well, now that it's light, they have a lot of bombardment on them, and they lose a lot of tanks and men because they're traveling around in the daytime. Although it can happen at nighttime too, but. It says, I'm going to try to hurry up here a little bit. So then this Myers group is still lost. Christ, that I told you about earlier, Christ has scouts out looking for them. Mark shakes his head and orders Christ to keep him posted. Some of these people are just disgusted beyond belief. And in front... In front of Marx, the enemy has apparently landed in five. Okay, I don't know, but the enemy, he finds out that the enemy has apparently landed in five main areas. The two areas on the left are American, and of the three on the right, two are British, and the third is Canadian. The assault troops are supported by a massive fleet whose size has dumbfounded the observers. The hundreds of aircraft flying overhead gave testimony to the air support that the enemy has committed to this. At 9 a.m., Baron von Heita, commanding the 6th Parachute Regiment, calls Marx. His men are moving toward Saint-Mère-Église. He has seen the invasion fleet and is stunned by its panorama. This is the invasion, von der Haidt tells Marx. Well, they're not sure about that at headquarters yet. At 9:10, Pemsel at 7th Army calls Speidel. He has been calling all night with reports, trying to get Speidel to understand what is happening. Finally, he stirs the man out of his complacency by tensely reporting that a massive landing had to take place on the Normandy beaches and that the beach defense zone has been breached already in several areas. They discuss what to do for a good half hour. A few minutes later, Blumentritt, another one of these traitors, calls to tell them that Jodl has again forbidden movement of the reserve panzers until Hitler releases them. Still, Rommel's headquarters stays optimistic. Rommel's headquarters is under the control of Speidel. Yeah, he's optimistic. At 10:10, Speidel decides that it's time to call Rommel back and tell him the news. Well, I guess Rommel hasn't left yet. He's getting ready to leave, but don't ask me. At Herlingen, the hours go by slowly. This is where Rommel is. Okay, he didn't leave. He's trying to kill time. He's fussing with the gifts on the table. He's trying to act normal, but he has no appetite. I guess the wife and the son are up and the day's going on. But, yeah, at 10:10, Speidel decided to call Rommel. At 10:15, Rommel's phone rings. It's Speidel. He confirms Rommel's worst fears. The invasion has begun. Well, I guess he's finally decided. It was in Normandy. As the chief adds some early details, Rommel listens in silence, the blood draining from his face. It means the chief of staff adds some details. He must return at once. I don't know why he didn't return right away, but he tells Lucy, his wife, they're both stunned. And then he comments softly. I guess somebody reported this. He finally comments softly, how stupid of me, how stupid of me. Once you realize what's going on and you see how you didn't see it coming, you know, you didn't react quite right either. Regaining his composure, at least he cares. He yanks the receiver up again, and he calls Okave and tells him where he's at and that he's returning to France at once. He tells his servant to call Lang, and he's going to Tempelhof. That's somebody's name, Tempelhof. That person will have to return on their own. And Rommel is out of the house in 15 minutes, leaving Lucy still in shock and discovering that her birthday shoes do not fit her. Sometime after 9 a.m., General Schmundt, Hitler's army adjutant, had woken up the Führer to tell him about the landings. Hitler calmly listens to Schmundt's report and then sends for Keitel and Jodl. By the time they arrive, he is dressed, but not so pleasant. They talk about the little information that has come in. It seems, though, that between Le Havre and the port of Cherbourg, some large enemy landings have occurred in the early morning. Jodl added that more were expected, but they did not know where. Jodl also tells him of von Rundstedt's order to move the reserve panzers forward, that he personally has countermanded the order until they have a better overall picture of what is happening, and the Führer can decide himself where to move them. Hitler approves of that, and Jodl is relieved to hear it. The Führer at this point is not sure if this is the primary landing. Twice he had said, this is not the main invasion. Well, what is he? He's not there, you see. He's got these reports, but he's just thinking what he thinks they would do. So, you know, he's he's not really up on it. The briefing is over, and he suddenly looks at them. Well, is it or isn't it the invasion? He wants them to answer him. But before they can reply, he turns and walks out of the room. Well, he's more upset about it than he's trying to let on. But he doesn't know what to do. Who knows? Nobody knows what to do. But you have to be there. You know, you have to go there, and you have to be there. And, of course, he's not going to go there, but the others have to be there. And by late afternoon, things have reached a strange pinnacle. At Okave, optimism reigns. Now the enemy would pay... Yeah, at Okave. Okay, that's Jodlin Keitel. And, you know, the enemy is going to pay for daring to step ashore on occupied Europe. Hitler releases the reserve panzers at 3:30 p.m. Now they're ordered to move in broad daylight. They will be harassed and pummeled mercilessly from the air by an overpowering enemy air force as they struggle up roads they could have traveled easily the night before. Now, I don't know how true that is, but that's what it says here. Rommel has picked up Lang, and he's driving hell-bent for Leather back to headquarters. Why are they driving? I wondered why he didn't fly. But no, they drove from wherever he was in Germany, probably in Western Germany, across France to Paris. He stops once to get an update. He doesn't arrive back at La Roche-Guyon until after 9 p.m. Too late to do much of anything until the next morning. His staff is crushed over the day's events, except for Speidel, who stays calm and above it all. At the front, the Germans have played their last card at destroying the beachhead. The 21st Panzer Division, finally in place to attack the British late in the afternoon, surge ahead into the long-awaited counterattack, with Marx himself leading one of the columns into battle. Von Opel, Bronkowski's panzers attack on the right, and Rausch's 192nd Panzer Grenadiers fan out to his left. The tanks themselves are stopped cold by a well-protected, well-camouflaged ridge of enemy tanks and anti-tank guns. So, you know, they got there too late to stop. They're already set up there and protected. The 192nd gets lucky, breaking through between the Canadians on the left and the British on the right. They smash through to the sea, relieving some beleaguered units there, but no help comes to support their advance, and they sit there on the beaches, feeling exposed. Von Opeln has not given up. Part of his men were dug in. The rest were ready to follow the 192nd up to the middle. Fuchtinger's confidence goes away at about 8 p.m. when, looking up, he sees the unmistakable sight of hundreds of parachutes falling in front of and behind the dug-in forward position of his panzers. Well, there you go. Getting the panzers down there so soon might not have been the best idea after all. He panics, thinking that this is an airborne attempt in reaction to his counterattack, with the paratroopers intending to cut his men off. Concerned about his rear, he calls off the entire attack on the beachhead and orders the withdrawal of the 21st to a new position behind them. Mark's men cannot stop the enemy coming ashore, even at Omaha. The Americans manage to get off the beach. The clearing weather makes it worse as the Allied Air Force and Navy pitch in to support the men behind the cliffs. The Germans, low on ammo, shocked by the day's fighting and seeing little relief, slowly begin to fall back. Von Rundstedt is infuriated over the Panzer episode, is in a bad temper all day as he struggles to get hold of the situation. And on the beaches, the Allies are far from being in a celebrating mood either. They are pretty sure that they are there to stay, but you just never know. The wise ones keep looking over their shoulders for a swarm of German tanks to descend on them. There's not much to celebrate. The long road ahead of them, you know, is there, and the fight has just begun in France, and thousands of their comrades already lay dead or dying at their feet. However, they're there. They're there to stay. So I've got some notes here that I might be able to get a few in. This thing about a phone call. Okay, this is the epilogue. Field Marshal Rommel will spend the whole night of June 6th and 7th getting updated on the military situation and then spend the next couple of days trying to organize some type of counterattack against the beaches. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I just remembered that I don't have to end the show exactly at what would be 4 o'clock for me. I can carry on a little bit more to do a proper ending. So that's what I will do. So be prepared to have the show stop without any closing music and to pick that up later in the, those of you who are listening live, to pick that up later. And I don't have any calls, okay, in the download. So I'll do what I think is important here, and then I want to have something a little more to say about the Leopold Wenger post. I wanted to talk about that a little bit. So Rommel is getting updated on the day of the 7th. He's in the next couple of days, actually. He's trying to organize a counterattack against the beaches. But he will not be able to, for although a few components of the 12th SS Panzer Division will arrive, it will not be nearly enough to make any kind of dent in the beachheads. They're so big, they're so vast. There's five of them. And besides, the Panzers will have been worn out by then. The line units are, for the most part, either shattered or barely holding on. The after story is one of three factors. Total Allied aerial supremacy over the beachhead, a men and materiel meat grinder, where fresh men and materiel come in on one side and leave the battlefield either dead or wounded on the other, and the ultimate failure of the German military command. With regards to the aerial supremacy, Fritz Bayerlein's Panzer Lehr Division is given the infuriating orders by General Dolman to move out around 4 p.m. on the afternoon of the 6th. His men, waiting now for some 15 hours, are finally forced to move in daylight. The cloudy skies of the morning have cleared, and the Allied fighters and fighter bombers swarm down upon the armored columns. God. Bayerlein will lose 20 or 30 vehicles before dusk. Moving through the night, he will be continually harassed by night attacks, with the enemy using flares to see. Rommel's grim predictions are coming to pass, that you couldn't hold back the armor and then bring it in later because you'd be destroyed by the airplanes. And on the 7th, as the march continues, his men will suffer more. Though cratered road junctions patrolled by fighters, patrolled by fighters, maybe some of these resistance people too, delayed in front of a damaged bridge, along narrow roads of trees with hedgerows and all this. All these things will delay them. By the end of the 7th, he will have lost 40 fueling tank trucks altogether. God. Carrying men or supplies, 5 tanks and some 84 half-tracks, prime movers, and self-propelled guns. The 12th SS will fare no better, and neither division will be ready for any kind of counterattack until the 8th, and even then they will still have units on the road. All over France, supplies and men trying to get to the front will be stymied and waylaid by Allied airplanes. The air war against supply depots, bridges, road centers, and railroad marshaling yards continues. The Loire River Bridge is untouched up until now, for fear that it would tip the Allies' hand on the landing location, are now hit full force, and the air war is expanded to include any and all German units moving up in column. So all the units that are moving up to the battleground is are being attacked. It's too depressing to read all this. And on the seas, it's no better. Attempts by the Kriegsmarine to attack the amphibious force will meet with grave results. Torpedo boats will be sunk. S-boats will either be turned back by aircraft, damaged, or sunk by surface craft. Submarines will struggle to make it to the landing area, and most will be depth charged before they get there. Wow! The rail lines will be swarming with enemy aircraft. Each train in turn will be attacked. Two whole trains will be all but destroyed. And so on. So it goes. Eventually, most of the panzer divisions in France will end up on the front. Although some, like the 2nd Panzer, 2nd SS Panzer, and the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier, will take too long to make it. So they don't get there, and the relatively nearby 116th Panzer will not even be committed before the first week in July. The ground war ends up being a material slugfest, as Rommel feared it might become. This is very pro-Rommel. I wonder if it's too pro-Rommel. You know, I wonder if it's written slanted so that we're getting an impression here that Rommel was right about everything when there might be other ways to look at it. But the enemy stayed ahead of the Germans, though barely at times. Four factors were at work against the Allies: the fierce determination of the panzer units, the natural defense of those maddening cross-sections of hedgerows, the failure of Montgomery to take Caen on D-Day, and Rommel's personal direction, which was, again, this person thinks is very good, you know, made a difference. These elements slowed the enemy down quite a bit and sent him weeks behind in his timetable. The Luftwaffe, trying to keep its word, sends squadrons of aircraft towards the front. But many pilots are new, and they are thrown against the masses of enemy formations piecemeal. They achieve little. German casualties in the campaign are not limited to the lower ranks. Many colonels and majors are killed. General Falley, commanding the 91st Luftland Division, is killed in a roadside ambush in the early morning hours of the 6th as he returns to his headquarters. Less than a week after the invasion, General Mark's command car is strafed by Allied aircraft, and because of his artificial leg, Marks cannot get out of the vehicle fast enough and is killed in the attack. General Dolman eventually loses Cherbourg to the Allies and falls from grace in Hitler's eyes. Disheartened and depressed, he commits suicide shortly thereafter, but it is covered up as a heart attack. Regarding the high command in Bavaria, well, it says here that Hitler continues to believe a second landing is imminent and keeps the 15th Army tied up at Calais for weeks, while his 7th Army continues to get slaughtered at Normandy. Second, he rushes to get the V1, I don't know about that. Third, he orders Rommel to start an investigation into the events of the 6th. With so many key leaders gone at the same time, at the same critical time, treason must be at play here, he thought. Rommel sees where this is going, and being a main perpetrator, he quietly drops it, since he was also missing. To cover tracks, though, certain points and phrases in the logbooks are checked and once in a while modified to cover their tracks. Last of all, Hitler allows life at the Berghof to continue as it has been. Well, there's nothing. He's never changed that with late night walks and talks. He's always stayed up late at night. He can't do otherwise. But this person wants to be critical of that. Well, Rommel becomes more and more convinced as the battle in Normandy progresses that resistance is pointless. Increasingly, he opens up to Speidel's plea to join the conspirators until July 17th. That's when he gets hit by the Allied aircraft himself and is mortally wounded, although he's in the hospital recovering. He's there for a few months. And 3 days later, after he was wounded, the famous assassination plot against Hitler fails. And and Rommel's name comes up as the planned leader of the new government. So Hitler sends emissaries to his home with the ultimatum to him: commit suicide and be buried with honors, or face a humiliating court-martial and have his family, you know, whatever happens to the family when that goes on, become disreputable. He chooses, Rommel chooses the former, and he is allowed to commit suicide and be buried as a hero. And Speidel is arrested and spends the rest of the war in prison. Von Rundstedt is dismissed by Hitler in July and then brought back in September. He needed him. Rundstedt spends the rest of the war fighting the Western Allies, but he does not. He oversees, but he does not really direct the Ardennes offensive, and he is captured at the end of the war. That's the end of that. It's all D-Day is a very depressing thing, and I would like to know if there are other. If there are other views of it that make things look a little differently than what I've given here today. But I want to close by talking about traitors and the damage that they do. I touched on that if anybody wants a call, too, you can call now. I'll make the show awfully long, but that's okay if you want to. I'm looking at it. But I'm going to go to another page and see about this. I'm jumping around here a little bit, but I posted yesterday the last letters from Leopold Wenger from the Eastern Front. And when I think about this young man, this young hero, who died at the age of 23 after an outstanding career as a fighter pilot, he's not one of the great aces or the most famous, but he had did an outstanding job and was always so so devoted to Germany and even to the Führer and to the whole process and gave his all in every way. And then you think about sometimes the way things turn out with the leadership. And in the leadership, of course, there are good people who are trying to do their best and are doing the best they can do, because nothing happens perfectly. And there are problems, but then you think of people who are traitors in connection with all these deaths that take place. And they will justify that by saying that if they could change the leadership, then they could stop the killing altogether. And in the end, it would save lives, even though they're exposing men to danger, their own soldiers to danger by the actions that they're taking to help the enemy. And they do always help the enemy. It always helps the enemy to, even if they weren't giving information to the enemy, which I believe all these men were involved in doing, they might not have all been the ones who were exactly doing it, actually doing it, but they knew it was being done, and they were in favor of the whole process, that they justify that. That unjustifiable action by saying that in the long run more lives will be saved. But they don't know that, do they? They don't know that. And I just want to make that point in this program before I go. And I've fallen in love with Leopold Wenger and his whole family, Willy Wenger, I've written about their parents and about Willie's wife, Wilma, and her brother, Albin. There's a story about Albin in here, what happened to him. And they gave their all, you know. They were such total patriots for for their country, and they had such idealism. And when you think of these people, like, well, the ones who are known to, like that whole group who was involved in the January 20th assassination, and what did they accomplish? They didn't accomplish it. Oh, I know, and the point that Hitler made afterwards and talked about and thought about was, what did they think they were going to do? What plan did they have? Did they have a plan? And he said that looking over everything that they had prepared, you know, that they could say for themselves and so on, that there was no plan. They just wanted to get rid of what was, and they thought they could do a better job, but they didn't have a plan. They did think that they could get the enemy, the British and the Americans and so on, to come to some kind of agreement with them. They thought that they could get a truce, they could get some kind of a surrender, they could get a good deal from them, because they were such good people, these German traitors, and they didn't like Hitler, and they wanted the world to be at peace and so on. So they thought that they could work something like this out. But as Hitler pointed out, they wouldn't have been able to. He had been trying that for so long, and it wasn't just him that they were against, that they, if some other German took over, that they would be nicer, and that they wouldn't want to fight them anymore. No, it wasn't that at all. It was that they wanted to defeat Germany and put Germany on its knees so they could then dictate to Germany from then on in their whole globalist plan, and never have another one of these type of Germans that keeps coming up all the time, you know, to challenge their authority. So and they've admitted that. So it isn't that they would have done any differently with these men. But these men didn't understand that, because they were caught in their own idealistic kind of thinking, or their own dislike of Hitler's type of governing and National Socialism and so on. So there you go. We have to realize that. I think it fits with the fact that some things I've been thinking, that people in the movement, in the pro-white movement, have this idea that they know what should be done, or they know things, but you know, what would their plan be? Nobody has a plan. We've got all these people talking and saying what they think and so on, but nobody has a plan. If they got an opportunity to take power, if things fell apart and power was somehow available to the people in the white nationalist movement, they wouldn't know what to do. Nobody would have an idea about what to do. So the right way of going about having a revolution or whatever is not taking place. It's just people playing games on the internet. There's nothing really serious going on, that certainly that I know of, or that anybody can see, and involving people who have any ability to do anything in the real world, in real life, and taking real power. They don't. And most of these people have never even been in any kind of service. They have never been in a war. That's not really a prerequisite, but it can make you into somebody who realizes how to deal with harsh reality. But I think there's a this is a lesson that when we look at history, we need to see, or when we look at our goals or whatever, we need to see what people actually have. Why spend time on comment boards and forums and stuff, just talking about what you don't like and who you hate and what should be done and this should be done and that? What good does any of that do? And then they say, well, you know, when we get power, we'll do this. Well, who's going to do it? And who knows how to do anything? there's something so juvenile about what's going on in amongst so many people, and they so many of them put on this pseudo-intellectual front, and they talk about issues that it's like while Rome is burning, they're talking about pseudo-intellectual subjects and spending hours of time doing it, and that is you know, while we're going down the tubes here, really. So you don't see people taking any, being realistic and taking any real actions that, so it looks like we just are going down the tubes. It looks like the white race cannot get it together. I think I'm going on too long here. So I better stop. I would like for people to write to me, if you would like to, about these Leopold Wenger letters. I got a very nice comment from, I'm going to go to it, from someone named Joe, who wrote that, I'm going to read it. I don't see any more there, but this is, I don't get hardly any comments on this, but Joe wrote, I write to thank you for posting the Leopold Wenger story, which I have followed with great interest. His death so close to the war's end adds to the tragedy. It's true. He died 1 month before the end of the war. No, 2 months, a little less than 2 months before the end of the war. He was a valiant young man, typical of many who died for Germany, and reading his story has made me very proud to know him. Well, I know a lot of people like this because it gets a lot of reads, but sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes they take off right away, and sometimes they're a little slower. But this is a very good one, this last one, and I do invite people to read it and to think about what it all means and to take our situation a little more seriously and think about all the people who have sacrificed and given their lives and given their youth for the true freedom, not this phony kind of freedom that Obama was talking about that I quoted in the beginning of the show. Well, I'm sorry for dragging this on so long. Probably wasn't all that necessary, but I'm going to close out now. I'm going to say goodbye. Thanks for listening to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. This is the June 7th, 2014. Yesterday was the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and that's what this program has been about. Thanks for listening.